and we're having fun, and we're here to entertain you. We want to thank you all again one more time for your participation in the fun drive that was concluded yesterday morning very successfully. Thank you all so much, and thank you, Jesse Ballou, for the opportunity for doing the show. Thank you all out there for tuning in. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Time for Community Voices. This is WJFF 90.5 FM in Jeffersonville, New York.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Community Voices, a program that provides a forum for the expression of public interests and concerns through interviews with the many people who contribute to our cultural development. This is a program about who we are as a community and what's important to all of us.
Our guest today on WJFF's Community Voices is Alice Zinnes, an artist whose exhibit of paintings entitled Rama's Light opened at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance Gallery at 37 Main Street in Narrowsburg, New York on October 7th and will continue through October 28th. Alice, welcome to WJFF's Community Voices, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to come.
It's a great pleasure. Tell us a little bit about your own background. Where were you born, and where did you grow up?
I was born in Oklahoma. I come from parents who are professors, and they were constantly getting sabbaticals or going on leave, and we traveled a lot. So I was born in Oklahoma. Then when I was in kindergarten age, moved to Princeton, where my dad taught for a little bit, and then we moved to New York. I lived there through most of my elementary school. And then for junior high, we went to Geneva, Switzerland. My dad was invited to the university there. That was pretty extraordinary experience. I was an impressionable kid. It was in the late 60s, early 70s. We left the States when all was calm and sort of the riots and the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, all those things kind of erupted while we were there. And I kind of looked to America as a European, seeing all these things that were happening, and it was kind of scary, actually. Also, I was of that age where I was very impressionable, and so living in Europe, being that young, has a lot to do with what my paintings look like now. So I was there for 2 years, and then we came back. I lived again in New York through high school, and then went to college in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, where I majored in art history, and then went back to New York City, where I went first to the New York Studio School for 3 years, and then I went to Queens College, where I got my master's. And I basically have been in New York City until I actually came up here for many summers and painted landscapes. Now I go back and forth between teaching in New York and coming up here.
Where do you teach?
I teach at Pratt and also at New York City College of Technology, which is a CUNY school. It's one of CUNY's commercial art schools, so I have all art students there. It is a nice contrast between the CUNY school and Pratt Institute.
What are the specific courses that you're teaching right now?
At Pratt, I teach a course that's called Light, Color, and Design. It's an amazing course. It's for freshmen. It's a foundation course, and it encompasses pretty much anything that has anything to do with two dimensions and color. So we use all sorts of materials. We use paint. We use colored pencils and crayons and collage and mixed media and pretty much anything you can think of. It's a course where we work from observation, we learn color theory, we also do abstract things, we work with design issues, we work with understanding how to use color and design to create some form of expression or content and idea. It's an amazing course, and the kids come in as high school students, very naive, and they leave as artists. It's pretty amazing. And for many students who are going on to commercial art, it's the only time they ever paint in their life, or unless they continue afterwards, but it's the only time they'll take any kind of painting course.
That must be a daunting situation for a teacher to be in a way, knowing that what they learn from you in this particular area may be the only time they're ever going to study it.
Well, it makes me feel that what we do is very important, and I take it very seriously, and I love what I do, and I really am glad I'm able to pass that on to the students.
Let's talk about your own career. When you began to paint and to take it seriously, what were you interested in? Who were your influences at that point? And how did you evolve into where you are today?
Well, the evolution, I always think, is kind of amazing. And it's actually something I'm able to tell my students a lot, because they're always questioning what they want to do. And I actually went to college in Swarthmore, which is not really known for its art, thinking I'd be a mathematician. And I took an art history class my freshman year, basically because I thought that you go to college, you're supposed to be cultured, and art history is a kind of being cultured. And one of the assignments was we had to go to the Philadelphia Museum and write a paper about comparing two paintings. And I couldn't find a reproduction of the second painting I had chosen. And in my naivete, I didn't think my teachers would know that painting. And so I thought, well, I guess I'd better draw it. And so I stood in front of that painting and I drew it. And it was really the first time since I was a kid I had drawn anything, really, and sort of. And I was amazed that, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours went by. I thought it was like 2 minutes. And I was even more amazed that the drawing looked like the painting. And I guess I was kind of hooked. I can actually say that was the day I got hooked.
That's really an interesting story. It's a lovely story. You don't remember the name of the painting by any...
It was by Jan Hals, but I don't remember the exact name of the paintings.
So it was a 17th century...
17th century Dutch, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Wow, interesting. Fascinating.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, you can't say that I was then, like, you know, so hooked that I knew exactly. I went through a big identity crisis because I had always thought I'd be a mathematician, and I loved math, and, like, to go from math to art was not an easy kind of switch, so it was... Then very hard kind of identity crisis I went through, but I definitely was hooked.
When you started to paint seriously, who were your influences and what kinds of things were you trying to do, if you can remember?
Well, I kind of then slugged it out, really, at Swarthmore, because I really didn't have much of art in studio art there at the time. And so I did art history, and then when I got out, I went to the studio school. And the studio school is an amazing place, and it was even more amazing when I was there. I was very lucky. It was kind of second-generation Hans Hofmann school. So all my teachers had studied with Hans Hofmann. Hans Hofmann was the fellow who had taught many of the abstract expressionists that we know. And if he hadn't taught them, he was very good friends with them. And so my teachers were also very good friends with de Kooning and Pollock and Gustin and all these people who are the greats from the New York art scene in the 50s. And so I kind of touched that whole world. And so that was very important to me. All those abstract expressionists were certainly a powerful influence, but also that the studio school was very strong on observation, and people like Cezanne, I think, were fundamentally important to me. There was a big show at the Modern when I was a student of the late work of Cezanne, which I remember going to every week. And Matisse also was very important to me, his sense of light, his sense of life and energy and just looking and creating a not exactly what he saw, but the feeling of what he saw, I think, was very important to me, too.
As I looked at the copies of your work on the internet, I thought to myself that I could notice at least two kinds of abstract painting. One that really concentrated on color and form and placement, and the other that did that but also had a program to it, if you understand what I mean. For example, you have a painting called The Woods I Live Here, and I noticed something in that that I've noticed more and more in contemporary, I don't know whether you call yourself postmodern or what, but in contemporary artists, and that is that the abstractions also have a composition that's very definable if you look at it. Sometimes you look at it a long time and it just suddenly pops out at you, and sometimes it's really apparent. And I've noticed that that's true of what I saw on the internet of your paintings, as well as other paintings. For example, you have a whole, what I think of as a whole series on the physical universe. It's almost as though you're doing paintings for the Big Bang Theory at certain points. So you get both paintings with specific compositions and paintings without them. And now I've given a lecture. Will you talk about abstract art and your place in it?
Oh, my goodness. I could say so much on that. I had a show a few years ago. It was kind of a retrospective. I had my older landscape paintings and what I'm doing now, which is more abstract. And person who came said, you know, Alice, I really think that these landscape paintings are abstract and your current paintings, which everyone thinks of abstract, are really landscapes. And I don't really see them as two different things. But what you just said about the Big Bang is really interesting to me, because I guess I was still painting those landscapes, but I've been doing them a long time. I read a book about chaos theory. It was kind of when that had come into the air, and I'd already been painting landscapes for 10 years probably. And I read this book and I went, oh my goodness, finally the mathematicians have caught up to me, because I was very much trying to see the pattern in the chaos of the world that I was looking at. I loved to go into the woods and there'd be these complicated entanglements of branches and light, and I'd love to try to find out, or a waterfall, and I'd love to try to find out what organizes this. And I guess that was part of the Cézanne fascination in me, that he also was organizing, and that's the structure, and maybe what you're seeing as the abstract form in the paintings is my desire to find order in here. What holds this together? What's the thing that's important in it? And so I think that kind of follows through in all my paintings, even to now, that that's the abstraction for me in a lot of ways. But then when we get into abstraction versus representation, it gets very, very complicated. Again, when I was painting landscapes, I read a book by Suzanne Langer called Philosophy in a New Key. She was a philosopher herself and had studied with Whitehead, and she was trying to herself understand what does art mean. And it was a very important book for me because it kind of justified the abstract desires that I had. And here I was looking at nature, really very involved with looking at and discovering the surprises. Oh, this tree in front of me is 5 times bigger than I thought it should be, or the rock needs to be purple, even though everyone knows a rock is gray. And somehow reading her helped me to put everything to perspective. And one thing that she did was she looked at primitive tribes, and she said primitive tribes do a rain dance. And they do the rain dance because they need rain. But they're not stupid, she says. In fact, they're very smart people. And they notice that sometimes when they do the rain dance, it rains, and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes when they don't do the rain dance, it doesn't rain. And sometimes it does. And so they must notice there's really no cause and effect between the rain dance and having rain. And so she says, why do they do the rain dance? And she says they do the rain dance because they need to express very deeply their desire for rain. And simply saying, we need rain, our crops are dying, is not a strong enough statement. It's that very powerful need to express something that's so critically important to them. And then she tries to understand, what is it about the dance that's able to express that? And to her, it's the rhythm, it's the dancing, it's the sound, it's the music, it's the beat. And then that becomes all what really is the abstract forms of any kind of art. And so I think that even when I painted the landscapes, I knew I was looking at the world perceptively, like I was really curious about what I was seeing, but that ultimately I also felt that my paintings were not really about that, that there was something else I was saying in them. And I did notice that I loved looking at rivers and how rivers flowed through and went somewhere, or roads where there might be a light at the end of the road. And I was very aware there was some kind of metaphoric statement, you know, like the light at the end of the tunnel, that there was some kind of metaphoric statement that I was making within all these abstract forms in these landscapes. And then I think now what I'm working on is I work from something I've read, and I'm trying to make a visualization of really the space and the light that it feels to me the emotional drama from what I've read would be taking place in. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of a reversal from what the landscapes were. The landscape itself gave me a form to hold on to within which I could make my kind of poetic statement. And now I have the poetry that I start with. That's the form that is defining it. And it's actually within that I make a statement of space and land and place.
I just want to remind our listeners very quickly that our guest today on WJFF's Community Voices is artist Alice Zinnes, whose exhibit entitled Rama's Light began at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance Gallery on October 7th and will continue for another week through October 28th. And before I ask you my next question, you reminded me of something, and I'm wondering if you ever came across a book entitled Essays in a Science of Mythology by Carol Karenyi and Carl Jung.
Well, I don't know that particular one, but of course I've read Jung, so.
This particular book is a fascinating book, and I recommend it to you because what you were saying reminded me of much of what they deal with in that particular book.
I will definitely read it. That sounds good. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the title that you've given this exhibit, Rama's Light.
Yeah, well, my initial desire for the title was to be more up to just sort of say Son of the Moon or something like that and really not mean anything. And then I felt like that wasn't really fair to the people who might come see the show. I should give a title that clue them in a little bit more to what they might see there. And as I just said briefly before, I currently am working from things that I read. And what I'm working from right now is the Ramayana. And the Ramayana is an ancient Indian epic, one of the major, I guess, Indian epics, that is a story of Rama, who is a god, I think he's Vishnu, who's come down to earth to do many things and to save the world, basically. But he goes through many trials and tribulations. He's been banished from his kingdom, and he's been forced to live in the forest, which is called the Dinaka. And I say that because there's a painting in the show called The Spirit of Dinaka, and that the Dinaka, I think that's how you pronounce it, I'm not sure, is this forest. And he's banished with his brother, and a big part that I'm touched with in the story is how close these two brothers are with each other and how they support each other through everything and respect each other. And he also is with his beautiful wife, who he adores, and it's sort of this love between them. Then she gets abducted, and then it's the trauma that he goes through with her loss, and then all the trials that he goes through in trying to regain her and save her, and then how much respect he has for everything that grows on the planet. And it's a beautiful story of morality, of love, of responsibility to one another. And it's very touching to me. And somehow, I don't know, I love myths, I think, because of how primordial they are, how real they are, how they touch such important aspects of what it is to be human. And I've been working with that. And so Rama's light refers to Rama, the god. And light, I just thought, was that kind of amorphous energy and beauty. And I guess I'm spiritual. I don't really think of myself as that, but I guess I really am.
I'm interested in something that you wrote where you talk about how your paintings look and your intention, and you say you use a palette knife and that color is important and that you teach color. Color, it seems to me, is extremely important, and I think very few artists really know how to use it. They can get the colors, but they don't know how to compose them on a canvas so that they become visually not just interesting but compelling and exciting. I was thinking in particular of one of your paintings that's on the internet called Smidgen of Blue, and I loved it because the manner in which you managed to get the colors and to blend them into a kind of an abstraction where I thought was a Delacroix sky. And you're probably going to laugh at me.
No, I love Delacroix. I mean, he's one of my heroes, so that's a wonderful compliment.
But I love that. You had another one called Purple Flower of China, where your use of color is really magnificent. I mean, you just get it right. Well, you know, if you look at a painting, you can tell right away whether the artist knew what she or he was doing with color. How do you teach that? Can you teach something? Can you teach something like that?
Well, you know, color is one of those things that there have been many books written about color, and Goethe, you know, wrote a whole treatise on color, and it's one of these really mysterious things. And I do teach color theory. There is something that is color theory. You can teach certain things. And I compare it to music theory, and what's very different about, I think, between color theory and music theory is that music theory, you can say this is a diminished seventh, and that's what it is, and that has a particular sound. And you can say this is a major chord, and it has a certain sound. You cannot do that with color. It is just impossible. Color just slips right through. You cannot make any rules. There are certain things that do happen, but there's such an incredible complexity about how the size, the texture, the exact pigment that you're using, and what's next to it, and the whole collection of colors and how they interact. You just cannot predict in advance very easily what that'll all be. So no, you can't really teach someone how to say something. You can give them tools. It's like you can teach people English, but you can't teach them to be a poet. I mean, you can have them read poetry. You can respond to what they've said, I understand it or not. But ultimately, you have to just try to be as truthful to yourself as who you are and it can possibly be. And that, I guess, I can, through my passion, try to teach. But you can't teach honesty. I mean, it's sort of...
Well, you know, it's interesting because you can see something that doesn't work. And you can try to describe it. You can say the juxtaposition of those two colors doesn't work here but you really can't. If you don't see it, you don't see it finally.
When I first started teaching art, it was kind of like this power trip and an ego trip because the students would do things and I could do that. I could say, well, if you put a big blob of blue over here, it's going to make everything look great. And they would try that and it would, the whole painting or whatever they're working on would just bloom and they'd be amazed that, wow, Alice saw that some blue over here was going to change everything. And I kind of felt good about myself, like, wow, I can like make this thing work. And there's certain things, particularly in young student work, where you can do that. It's pretty clear. But then when you're getting to where I guess what I'm trying to do, which is to try to make a statement that is really what I deeply feel. I mean, I very much keep trying to to just get to my core, like how deep into my inner soul can I get out there on the canvas. And when you're trying to do that, it's very hard even to know what that is that you're trying to say. And so to know whether you want blue or red is not actually as clear. You know, people sometimes say that artists are stupid in some ways, and they say there's all right brain, they're not thinking, and that really disturbs me because I think that there's a lot of both right and left brain working, and it's, to me, the balance between the two of them. And I always, actually for me, think it's a very Zen experience, that painting for me is how can I somehow let go of everything I know consciously so that it just sits there behind as a background somehow, and so I can just completely be there in the moment, and so that my knowledge and experience is obviously there. It's not like I forget it. It's not like it's gone. I don't think Zen or any of those Eastern religions is about non-existence. It's somehow, to me, I think it's about allowing that to flow through when it needs to, how it needs to. I think that's probably the hardest part of painting. It's not learning that red and yellow makes orange. It's how to allow the knowledge to just quietly be there while the content is able to come out.
Well, it's very interesting to see how you managed to achieve this with your paintings. And I certainly hope that a lot of our listeners are going to rush right down to the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance in Narrowsburg, New York, to see your exhibit, which is entitled Rama's Light, and will be hanging there through October 28th. A reminder that our guest today is Alice Zinnes. You talk about using the palette knife. Is that your exclusive tool when you're dealing with oil?
Well, it's almost my exclusive tool. When I painted the landscapes, I did those entirely with brush. And in fact, I thought of those as just drawing with paint, that they're kind of like pollocks, really, a kind of weaving of brush strokes of color. But I never could really do like big solid areas because I had to just do this constant weaving with a brush. And I discovered it's kind of bizarre because I painted with a brush for, I don't know, 15 years. I found out I actually am kind of scared of the brush. And a palette knife, for those listeners who don't know quite what it is, it's sort of like a spatula, though they come in all different sizes. You can get them from like a quarter of an inch, say, to a foot long or longer. And you can mush the paint around. And it's sort of, to me, like playing in a sandbox. It's like I can mush the paint. It's very direct. I feel like my hands are on the canvas. And also, really, you don't have exactly as much control in some ways with a palette knife as you have with a brush. But I guess I've worked with it for so long that I've developed my own kind of control with it. But it seems for me to allow for all sorts of surprises, which I either keep or don't keep in the painting. It feels very direct. And I think that's why I like the palette knife.
One of the things that you said that really interests me is that Pollock exerted an influence on your life, and he's obviously a very controversial figure, but he seems to me to be very far away from what you're doing in some ways, so I wonder if you'll just talk about that.
Well, I think in some of my earlier landscapes, it's maybe more obvious because they were this constant interweaving of brushstrokes. And I think that sort of cosmic space that you picked up on in those paintings, I think I really see and saw in Pollock, that sense of looking up at the stars and you can't quite pinpoint where everything is, but you know this is further than that, but maybe that's further than this, but you know there's space there. And I think that was a lot of what my landscape paintings had in them. I guess now for me, Pollock is probably less a direct influence, but I guess it's more his passion that I would kind of hold on to.
One of the things that I really admire in you is that you are willing to talk about artists who have influenced you. And yet, as I look at your paintings, I think that you are very true to one of the things that Octavio Paz, the great Mexican writer, says, that we must not neglect the past, but we must turn it into something that is us.
Well, you know, along with that, T.S. Eliot had Poetry and the Individual Talent, or something, I don't know, it's just escaped me the name of this essay he wrote. But in it, he says that the history of poetry he's talking about is always complete. And the new poet, which in his mind would be him, when the new poet comes along, he adds to the completion. And so he's sort of saying that that new poet comes out of that history, but then is not a victim of it, and he's contemporary, he's doing something that's very new. And I'm glad you said what you said, because I think that in my paintings, I clearly do come out of the tradition and the history of art, but I don't think of them as reactionary paintings. I don't think of them as academic paintings. I think of them very much as contemporary paintings. In fact, at the opening, I was talking to someone about how my paintings are actually political in this very non-kind of obvious way. And as we were talking about how the world's falling apart and how crass things seem to be in the commercialization, and people seem to be searching for something that they're not getting. And I feel that art is really a place where that search should be found, and I feel very strongly that I would like to be part of that finding, where that we can be living in the world, but there's still an inner core of humanity that we have. So that, in that sense, I think my paintings are actually very political.
Alice, I have a question I want to ask you that always interests me. Do you actually visualize pictures or faces or whatever it is, or is it an abstraction somehow or other that you're able to get onto the canvas?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that, because that's probably the core of what my work's about right now. I'm sure it's happened to you where you're reading something and the author's words are very descriptive. So you have a person walking, you see a tree, you see the sun shining, and you visualize the person walking, the tree, and the sun. But also, because it's a good author, there's something going on, so the person's either feeling sad or happy or is about to meet someone else. There's all these other levels that are happening while you read that, and that's all part of the way the sun on the tree and the man is connected. And so when I'm painting, I'm trying to get all of that together. My paintings really, to me, are landscapes. There are people in them, even though it may look at first that they're abstractions, but they really are where I'm trying, through the color, the light, the space, to recreate that person walking under the tree with the sun and all of those other layers of tensions and drama and emotions that are going on in that passage at that time.
So these are really clues to what we should be looking for when we go to the exhibit.
Well, I'm often surprised when people tell me, is this a whatever, and they start describing the paintings, and of course they're not going to know what the literal story is they came from, but they'll make their whole other drama, and it will be somewhere where the intrinsic emotional quality is very similar to what mine was in some ways, and I'm always so intrigued and happy about that. So that's ultimately what I want. I don't want them to see these as illustrations of a story, but as avenues into a place to dream about all these kinds of deep emotional dramas.
One more question that's related to this. Do you use a sketchbook?
I do. I actually make fairly large drawings as preparation for the paintings and as drawings in themselves. And some of the watercolors in the show are that too. They're these small watercolors that are intimate studies that are part of the painting process. And I draw all the time.
Wow. Interesting. Alice Zinnes, I can't believe this, but we are about to run out of time.
That's
and
fast.
We haven't even begun to talk about all the things that I want to talk to you about. Is there anything else that you want to say at this point before we really have to say goodbye?
Well, at the opening, you know, there are all these people that I didn't know who came, and I'm still kind of recuperating because so many people came up to me almost with tears in their eyes saying, I just have never seen anything so moving in so long. And one woman said, you know, these are abstract paintings. I don't understand why they're so moving to me. And I said to her, well, they're not really abstract paintings. And I guess that's really what I want to have happen with my work. I want my paintings to be places where people can dream, where they can just kind of get into their own world. One woman said she wanted to come back and just put a chair in the gallery and just look at the paintings for a long time. And it just gives me the shivers to think of this, because it's really what I want my paintings to do.
Well, Alice, you know, I think that we're all victims of the manner in which the popular press presents art to us. And I think this is one of the reasons, for example, that contemporary classical music is detested, because people are afraid to listen to it and find out what it's all about, because they've been told that they won't be able to understand it. So what you say is extremely interesting.
Well, thank you.
Our guest today on WJFF's Community Voices has been Alice Zinnes. Her exhibit, Rama's Light, a series of paintings, has been on view at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance Gallery since October 7th and will continue for another week until October 28th. If you wish further information, you can call the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance Gallery at 845-252-7576. Alice, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you. It really was a pleasure. It's a lot of fun.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's Community Voices. The views expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WJFF. We welcome your comments and suggestions as they help us make this your forum. You can write us at P.O. Box 546, Jeffersonville, New York 12748, or direct email to wjff@wjffradio.org. Our voice box line for listener comments is 845-295-1040. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next week at this time to learn more about our unique community.
You're tuned to WJFF, 95 FM in Jeffersonville, New York, and 94.5 FM in Monticello, New York, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This afternoon at 4 p.m. at the Cooks Falls Fire Hall, Mr. Kelly Keck, who is the candidate for the Democratic Party for the New York State Assembly, 107th District, will be available to meet voters and citizens to talk